Welcome to the Grateful American Radio Show, hosted by author and publisher David Bruce Smith. What did George Washington do that you might not know about? What did Abe Lincoln know that could change the way you think about the Civil War? You'll learn about all that and more on this special show designed to restore excitement in American history. Let's get started. Hello and welcome to the Grateful American Radio Show. This series is an interactive multimedia program designed to restore enthusiasm in American history for children and grown-ups too. The hosts for the show are DC author and publisher David Bruce Smith, creator of the Grateful American series, and I'm your co-host, Hope Katz Gibbs, founder of Incandescent Public Relations and Incandescent Radio Network. So hi, David. Welcome to your show.
Hi, Hope. I'm really excited to be here because we are interviewing Adam Goodhart, author of 1861 and the upcoming 1865.
Yes, Adam is an amazing historian, essayist, and journalist. His articles have appeared in National Geographic, Smithsonian, The Atlantic, and the New York Times Magazine, among others. In fact, he's a regular columnist for the Times' acclaimed Civil War series. It's Disunion, is that right, Adam?
That's right.
He lives here in D.C., as we do, and he's on Maryland's Eastern Shore, where he is the director of Washington College's C.V. Starr Center for the Study of the American Experience. So welcome to the Grateful American series.
It's so great to be here.
Thank you. Now, before we launch into our Q&A, we want to tell our listeners a little bit about 1861, the Civil War Awakening. This is a gripping and original account of how the Civil War began and is an epic of courage and heroism beyond the battlefields. Early in that fateful year of 1861, a second American Revolution unfolded, inspiring a new generation to reject their parents' faith in compromise and appeasement and do the unthinkable in the name of an ideal. It set Abraham Lincoln on the path to greatness and millions of slaves on the road to freedom. So Adam, let's talk about your book. It introduces us to a heretofore little-known cast of Civil War heroes, among them an acrobatic militia colonel, an explorer's wife, an idealistic band of German immigrants, a regiment of New York City firemen, and a young college professor who would one day become president. So tell us, what inspired you to write 1861?
Well, it actually started with a sort of discovery of buried treasure, almost literally buried treasure. And it also started from my work as a teacher, as a college teacher out on the Eastern Shore of Maryland. And if you've been to the Eastern Shore, you know that it's this sort of land that time forgot, an area with lots of old crumbling plantation houses and a little colonial village kind of tucked away along these tidal rivers. So when I'm teaching American history out there, I love to take my students out exploring the environment, exploring these places where you really feel history come alive. And about 7 or 8 years ago, I took one of my classes to one of these old plantation houses, a place that had been in the same family since the 1600s, more than 13 generations in this one family. And as we roamed through this old brick house, we found in the attic all of these boxes and barrels and old steamer trunks stuffed with family papers. And there were about 13 generations of family papers, so they ranged from land records from the 1660s up to like somebody's credit card statements from the 1980s. It's all jumbled up together. But mixed up in this treasure trove, we found a bundle of letters from the spring of 1861, letters that had been written by a man who lived on this plantation and who was trying to figure out what it all meant as the country fell apart, as the South seceded, as Maryland, where he lived, considered whether to be a Union state or a Confederate state. And as my students and I read through these letters, letters that hadn't been read in 150 years, they were tied up in this bundle with silk ribbon that clearly hadn't been undone since the 19th century. As we read this, it just brought that moment to life, and I realized that I wanted to write a book about it.
Wow.
How did you know who to bundle together? Mm-hmm. You have James Garfield, who became president.
Every book needs James Garfield. I mean, the man is just obviously the most fascinating American president.
Jesse Fremont.
Yep. The famous, the wife of the famous explorer, John Fremont.
How did you, I mean, it's an odd Abner Doubleday. It's not odd. It's an eclectic group.
Good, that's a good word, David. An eclectic, I like that. Eclectic cast of characters. Well, you know, my background as a writer, rather than being a traditional academic historian, I got started as a journalist. And when you're a journalist, as you know, you have to be ready to walk into a place, walk into a room, and just have that sort of sixth sense almost of who are going to be the interesting people here to talk to? Who are the people I really want to interview for my story? And that's kind of my approach as a historian. I sort of step into that room, that foreign country of a moment in the past, and I look around for the people who intrigue me. And it's almost something that, I don't know, it's almost just an instinctive thing that I feel. So I didn't expect to write about James Garfield, for instance, at all. I mean, I always thought James Garfield was one of the most boring sort of 19th century presidents. I just knew him as a guy who had a big bushy beard.
And you called him ugly.
No, he was handsome, actually.
In the book, he's described as ugly, I think.
No, well.
Or maybe somebody said he was
ugly.
Yeah,
maybe somebody thought so. But he was considered to be pretty handsome. But, you know, I thought of him as this guy who was president for about 5 minutes, then was shot by a madman, and that was it. Well, just in reading around about what was going on in 1861, I started coming across excerpts from his letters and diaries that just made it clear that at that moment, 20 years before he was president, he was just an ordinary young American man in his 20s trying to figure out what it all meant, similar to the man in the plantation house I discovered, trying to figure out what this war was going to be, what it would mean for his personal future and the future of the country. And his personality and his words really just pulled me in, and he became a character in my book, and people have said he's one of the more exciting characters in the book.
So what is it about the Civil War that's so important for everyone to understand, especially for kids?
Well, the Civil War, for one thing, I think it's really great to read about and understand, because it's just such an amazing story. I'm a believer that history is all about storytelling, and we look not just for the things that are significant with a capital S, or influential when you look at what's happening in the current times, but also just for the great epic stories. And the Civil War really has it all. It has amazing characters from Lincoln and Grant and Frederick Douglass and so many greater and lesser known heroes, that it's sort of one of these stories like the Iliad and the Odyssey, these ancient Greek myths that we keep telling and retelling through the generations and across the centuries and across thousands of years, just because they speak to us so much as human beings. And I think that also speaks to an idea that the Civil War is important because it really cuts to our identity as Americans. As Americans, we don't all share the same ethnic background, we don't all share the same religion, we don't all share the same political ideas, but what we all share is the same history. We share this set of stories that whether our ancestors came here 300 years ago on the Mayflower, or whether they got off the plane from Vietnam 5 years ago, that's what makes us all American, these stories. And that's why I think it's something that's very important for Americans of every background, of every belief, and of all ages to share and understand.
Mm-hmm. Would you say that the Civil War was the beginning of civil rights?
I don't think it was the beginning of civil rights in America, because of course people have been fighting for civil rights since the very beginning in various ways. People have been fighting for rights within this new, not before it was even a new nation.
But I mean in a formal
way.
But
I think that the Civil War marked a major turning point in the struggle for civil rights. It really marked the moment when the struggle against slavery became a struggle over what is the definition of citizenship going to be in our country. And it's amazing to think that even the people who believed in the American slaves having their freedom, many of them didn't think that African Americans should be or could be citizens. They thought that people of African descent, just for various reasons, should be excluded, must be excluded forever from becoming Americans. And so for African Americans, the Civil War wasn't just about gaining freedom, it was also about gaining citizenship. And that's what in the end they managed to do to a significant degree, but then that was taken away from them to a significant degree as well. And the next 100 years becomes really the story, more than 100 years, becomes really the story of making sure that the promise of what was given in the Civil War would be fully fulfilled and realized. So you're absolutely right. This was a moment that was a watershed for civil rights and that really set the course of a lot of American history for the next 100 or 150 years.
So talk a little bit about the women. Jessie Fremont, she played a big role in the war. And would you say that 1861 is one of the few books of this genre that gives thought and credence to women of this era?
Well, there have been good books about women in the Civil War era, but I found some women characters that I absolutely loved. And one of them, as you say, is Jessie Fremont. She was a woman who, well, first she was famous for the sort of famous men she was associated with. Her father was Thomas Hart Benton, a very famous U.S. senator, among the other things that he was famous for, challenging a man to fight a duel with pistols at, I think it was 5 feet in distance. He was really just a rough, tough frontier character. And then she also married another tough frontier character, John Fremont, who was a great explorer of the American West, crossed the Rocky Mountains, ran for president, did all these amazing things. But Jessie really was more remarkable than these two men in many ways. And she really tried to step into the spotlight herself in politics at a time when women, certainly sort of upper class women, were banned from entering the political arena. She really worked sort of behind the scenes manipulating the politics in California where she was living. And people tend to forget about California and the far west and thinking about the Civil War. We think it was something that happened on some battlefields in Virginia and Georgia and Tennessee. But Californians were actually considering whether or not they should leave the United States and form their own whole new country. And Jessie Fremont worked from behind the scenes to try to keep California in the U.S. And so she's a very little known hero of this era and somebody who not only was working to save the Union, but was working to stretch the limits of what a woman could achieve in this very restrictive political environment of the time.
Let me ask you, how long did it take you to write 1861?
Well, let's see. I was 40 years old when it was published, so it took me about 37 years. Well, I mean, any book is really a project that you've been inspired to write, you've been developing in your mind your whole life in some ways. But this particular book, really, I started thinking about it, I guess, about, well, 10 years before it was published. In different forms, these ideas were germinating in my mind. But really, the writing itself just took me about 2 years.
So when you spend so much time with James Garfield and Jessie Fremont and Abner Doubleday and that whole clique, do you feel like you get to know them?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And it's amazing as a historian, one of the things that I love about writing history is that you feel like in some ways you can get to know these people almost better than they knew themselves, or at least you can get to know the circumstances that they were working in better than they knew it themselves. So if you're reading about President Lincoln and what was going on for him politically as the Civil War began, you can read what Lincoln was thinking and saying and writing in Washington as he tried to figure out his political strategy, but you can also read what Jefferson Davis was writing and thinking and doing as he figured out his strategy for the war. So you know things that Lincoln didn't know about Davis and things that Davis didn't know about Lincoln, and you can put it all together and get a perspective that somebody at the time wouldn't have gotten. So that's a very powerful thing.
So how do you transmit that feeling to kids and adults to want to know people like a Garfield or a Fremont
Lincoln
or a Lincoln? Well, I think Lincoln sits above everybody.
Sure.
I mean, I think Lincoln is just almost universally beloved. But I don't think anybody else has his, I don't think anybody else in American history has his stature.
Well, I really believe that history has to be storytelling. And you have to try to put people in the shoes, people today, readers today, in the shoes of people at that time. So many historians sort of write, and I'm not saying all historians, there are many wonderful historians I admire, but there are some historians who write, I don't know, as though people in the past were just these sort of robots whose actions were determined by certain economic and social and political forces. And you almost lose sight of these as flesh and blood human beings with all the same passions, with all the same doubts, with all of the same wants that, that we have now. And so I think it's most important to create fully rounded flesh and blood characters who aren't perfect. Like Lincoln in my book is somebody who's really blundering and stumbling a lot of the time before he really begins to find his footing as a leader. So don't try to make these people into gods, and also don't try to just make them into little sort of repositories for whatever your pet academic theory is. Bring them out on the page as actual human beings.
Which they were.
Absolutely.
And that era.
All of us are.
I had one of my PR clients was the Lincoln Leadership Institute at Gettysburg, and they were explaining to me how this was a very romantic time. People spoke in very flowery language. Did you find that as well in your research, and can you tell us more about that?
Absolutely. People wrote just these amazing letters, and I'm not just talking about Abraham Lincoln, but ordinary folks.
The soldiers.
The soldiers wrote absolutely beautifully. You know, this was a time when people were just steeped in the great literature. I'm a great believer that you write what you read. So if you want to be a wonderful writer, the most important thing to do is to read wonderful books and poems and essays. And this was a time in history when people were reading great stuff. They were reading Shakespeare. They were reading the Bible. They were reading the great 19th century poets Byron and Tennyson. And they were absorbing these cadences, they were absorbing the rich language, and they were writing that way themselves. So one of the great pleasures for any writer in writing about that era is just getting to read their words.
Gettysburg did an exhibit of Civil War letters maybe 3 years ago. I mean, there were hundreds of letters written by soldiers, and they were just beautiful. They were poetic.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's true. There. I mean, all these allusions to Shakespeare or the Romantic poets. I mean, it's just not the kind of language you would find today.
That's right. Yeah, you come across these lines of just reading a letter from James Garfield. And this is when he was an ordinary. He was a young college professor in his mid 20s, writing to an old college friend of his, and he wrote in one letter just as the war was beginning, "An awful certainty is fixing itself upon the hearts of men."
Mm.
I think, what a wonderful Shakespearean line, just the rhythm of it. And this was the way that ordinary people wrote.
So we're trying to tease out why kids aren't turned on by history. So maybe you can offer some thoughts about things that they could read and that other ideas that parents especially can do to infuse this enthusiasm.
Well, I think the most important thing, you know, the U.S. Marines talk about getting your boots on the ground. And I'm a real believer in boots on the ground, teaching and learning as well. I really think that if you get out there and walk the places where history happened, walk the battlefields, walk through the towns and villages, explore, and don't just look at the historical markers, but read. Take a book out to one of these places. I've had such powerful experiences taking a book to a Civil War battlefield and reading about what happened there on the spot, and you just see it unfolding. Read aloud to each other when you go to a place like that. Talk to people as well. Go to, for instance, near where I live and in many, many places, there are African-American communities that were founded by freed slaves right after the Civil War, and I take my students sometimes. There's a wonderful church out in Maryland, this is an hour and a half from Washington, founded by the descendants of freed slaves, and where descendants of those families still live there. And you can go to the church services and experience a service, probably much what African American religion would have been like in the 19th century, and then stick around afterwards and talk to people, hearing stories of when they were growing up. And there's still people alive today, amazingly enough, who remember Civil War veterans. It's not that long ago. So talk to old folks and hear those stories, and you'll hear things that nobody else knows.
How cool to be taught a class on this topic by someone who's written this book. Your students are lucky. Tell us a little bit about your class.
Well, I love teaching, and one of the things that I really enjoy doing with my students is not just taking them out and exploring, but also letting them go out on their own and make discoveries, giving them assignments to find out stuff that I don't know. I think sometimes students get into the habit of trying to come up with, sort of guess what the teacher already knows and wants to hear regurgitated back. I don't want that. I want my students to tell me something I don't know. So for instance, last year, I assigned my students to research the lives of African-American Civil War soldiers from our little town in Maryland. And they went out and started digging around, dug through the courthouse, dug through the state archives, the old newspapers, and wrote biographies of these men and their families, life stories that had been completely forgotten for 150 years. And then they brought them back, and they shared them, and they talked about them, and they wrote biographies that were actually published online. And so, to me, that's the best kind of teaching, when I can end up learning and when my students can end up teaching.
Does that create, at least sometimes, does that create or make a student who was disinterested initially interested in history and then go on to something else, historically speaking?
Absolutely, yeah. I've been teaching actually only about 10 years now, but one of the great things about being a teacher, especially a college teacher, is that the students graduate and then they move on, and it seems like yesterday that they were first-year students in college, when you're suddenly hearing about the amazing things that they're doing out in quote-unquote the real world. Terrible expression, because of course college is the real world too, but I had a student who took a class with me as a sophomore and is now a historian working for Congress. He does oral histories of people who served in and worked for the House of Representatives, and it's just, he loves it. He says he jumps out of bed in the morning every day and can't wait to get to work. And so I love when I hear those stories. And I have students who are writing books, but when I hear those stories of people who are carrying this with them, it's just the best thing in the world.
Adam, can you tell us three fascinating things that our viewers and listeners should know about 1861, the book 1861.
Everything about 1861 is fascinating.
Well, pick three.
Gosh, it's so hard. Okay, well, one of the stories that I like the best in the book is in the next to the last chapter, I tell the story of how freedom really began for enslaved African Americans. And this isn't the story that most people think of, where Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation and then Congress passed a congressional amendment setting all the slaves free. This is a story about how the slaves, the African Americans, decided to free themselves in the very first days of the Civil War and seized freedom. It starts with three completely unknown young men, Shepard Mallory, Frank Baker, and James Townsend, who in the first weeks of the Civil War escaped from a Confederate encampment where they were being held in bondage as laborers, made their way across the river to a Union fort, and were taken in and given their freedom by the Union general, starting an absolute flood, an outpouring of enslaved people running to the Union lines, joining the Union cause, helping out the Union war effort, and really seizing freedom for themselves and forcing the issue of slavery onto the table in the Civil War at a moment when almost nobody, including Abraham Lincoln, wanted it there. So that story, people have told me, is just an amazing part of the book. It was excerpted in the New York Times Magazine, and I was surprised the New York Times Magazine, which is very current and timely, would want a story 150 years old. I thought, well, okay, if they want to publish it, that's fine with me. Well, that became the most emailed story of the week that it was published. People just picked up so much on that story. So I think it's something that's excited people. Another part of the book, I guess, that I like is the story of a young colonel named Elmer Ellsworth, really a young man who came from out of nowhere and led a movement called the Zouave Movement, which were these guys who would go into battle dressed in the most weird uniforms, these little fezes and big baggy red pants, and they would sort of, when they were fighting, they would kind of jump into the air and pirouette and twirl their muskets and turn somersaults. They were sort of like, you know, the Navy SEALs meet the Cirque du Soleil, basically. So that is an amazing story. And the story of what happened to him and how he became the first martyr of the Civil War is also something that appeals to me. And I guess finally, I might mention Lincoln himself. And people have told me that my book presents a very different Lincoln from any they've read elsewhere. And my Lincoln is a man who comes to Washington as a complete political unknown, very naive in many ways about politics, really not understanding the way that Washington works in many respects, and being totally at sea in the midst of the worst crisis in American history. And yet, in the weeks and months to come, he transforms himself into one of the greatest leaders, if not the greatest leader America has ever known. So that Lincoln, who starts out as a sort of a bumbler and a stumbler in the early chapters of my book and becomes a great president in the final chapter, is one that I really enjoy telling.
Well, there's hope for us all.
Well, almost all.
So as we conclude, tell us a little bit about this upcoming book, 1865.
Well, now I'm working on a book that tells the other end of the war story. It tells the story of how everything ended and how there was a battle that was fought at the end of the Civil War, even after the last shots were fired, about what would this war ultimately mean? Would it be simply about changing things back, turning back the clock to the way that America was before the South left the Union, which is what a lot of people wanted to do, or would it be about bringing forth, in Lincoln's words, a new birth of freedom? And that's something that was very much up in the air, that was very much uncertain as the Civil War ended. And that's what I'm writing about in the new book.
Fascinating. Well, when that comes out, we'll have to have you back on the show. Thank you so much for your time, Adam.
Thanks, Hope, and thanks, David.
Thank you, Adam.
We are here today with Adam Goodhart. Be sure to check out his book, 1861, and upcoming 1865. At www.adamgoodhart.com. That's it today for the Grateful American Radio Show on the Incandescent Radio Network. Here's to restoring enthusiasm in American history for children and adults, too. We look forward to talking to you soon. You have been listening to the Grateful American Radio Show, hosted by author and publisher David Bruce Smith. Here's to restoring enthusiasm in history for kids and adults, too.